I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Today I'm doing it solo. I am going to have an Ask Me Anything session, and I invite you all to ask me anything. So if you would like to do that through Entropy, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. It's written across the bottom of the screen. And you can leave your question or comment along with the donation, and I will get to it in the course of today's stream. Also, if you are using DLive and you would like to send a DLive token or two, a diamond, lemon, ninjet, ninjagini, whatever, I'd be most grateful. I will also, of course, answer your question or comment as well. And the same goes for the people over at Odyssey. We have about 16 people over there at Odyssey, and I apologize to the Odyssey folks because in the past I have overlooked you, but I'm going to close eye on your questions as well. So with that, let's begin. And I want to run through some questions that have come in already. People have been sending me a number of questions. And the first question is a kind of serious question. It comes from Mary Ann. First time I've heard from Mary Ann, at least under the name Mary Ann. So welcome to the show. Mary Ann writes, did you have a midlife crisis? What did you learn? I think this is a polite way of asking me if I'm over the hill. Yes, I'm definitely over the hill. I have more life behind me than I do ahead of me, based on any reasonable actuarial tables that one can consult. And the question is, though, did I have a crisis about this? What is a midlife crisis anyway? Well, as I understand a midlife crisis, it basically happens when you realize you've got more time behind you than you do ahead of you. And you start panicking. A lot of cliched midlife crisis moves are guys getting a convertible and trying to appeal to younger girls or things like that. Basically, it has to do with grasping after one's departing youth, right? And of course, this is the staple of jokes because it is a joke. It's undignified to run after something that's gone, to resist the inevitable. The only thing you can do about the passage of time is basically deal with it in a dignified fashion. And that's basically what I advise to people is just to recognize that, yes, life will go on and you will die eventually. You're going to have to come to grips with the fact that you're going to die. Now, I did not have a midlife crisis per se. And I think the reason that I didn't have a midlife crisis per se is that it never hit me all at once that I'm going to die around middle age. I was constantly aware of my own mortality through my entire life. I think when I was a teenager, I started thinking about mortality. It's a bit morbid, I admit. But I was acutely aware of the fact that I was going to die someday. And what that does is it makes you a little more serious. There's a kind of a psychological cliche, but I think it's basically true, that when you're young, you live as if you are immortal. Meaning this, that young people tend to think that, yeah, I'll die someday. And it's an abstraction, though. And if they picture it, they're picturing it out there in the distance waiting for them sometime. Well, if your death is something that's sort of out there in the future waiting for you at some fixed time, what does that imply about the present? Well, if you only die once and your death is somewhere off in the future, the distant future, you hope, then in the present, it's as if you're immortal, right? Because your death is postponed. You've only got one, it's off in the future, and that means now, well, you can act silly. You can act like you're immortal. You can fritter away your time. And that is a fundamentally false understanding of mortality. So when the midlife crisis hits, it usually comes in the form of realizing that, wait a second, you still have this picture of your death out there in the future around 70 or something like that, right? Or in your 80s or whatever. And now you're halfway there. And so you get the chill. Well, that chill that a lot of people get is nothing compared with the chill of facing up to the fact that at any moment you can die. Your death is not something that's out there in the future waiting for you at some fixed time, fixed by God or destiny or whatever. Your death is something that you carry with you at all times. It's a possibility that you have at all times. We can die at any moment. And I was one of these people who was acutely aware that you could die at any moment. And because I was acutely aware that I could die at any moment, I tried to be serious about life and serious about plans to the best of my ability at any given time. And so I never experienced a midlife crisis per se. I experienced something far worse or far more shocking in a way. I just experienced the sort of existential crisis that you have when you realize you could die at any moment. And it didn't happen because of an accident or something. A lot of times people will live carelessly because they think they're immortal, and then they have some brush with death and it makes them serious. For me, it was something that was very real at all times, not because of an accident or anything like that, or a brush with death. Although I've stupidly blundered into traffic and made mistakes that could have killed me over and over again throughout my life. But it was simply something that it wasn't a stretch for me. It wasn't something that I needed to have a dinned into my head by events. It was just real at all times. And so I tend to be a serious guy, right? I'm a serious guy, meaning that I try not to sweat about small things because life's short. And as one gets older, one is more aware that, okay, there's less time ahead, because that is true. There may be no time ahead, right? But there, if the actuarial tables pan out, there's certainly less time ahead, and you just have to become more and more serious about the time that you've got. And so as I've grown older, I think the changes have been not so much some midlife crisis, it's just a greater willingness to let small things slide, and a greater impatience with petty things, and a greater impatience with stuff that's transient. And that's just based on the fact that I've got limited time. I have enormous ambitions, limited time, and that means I've just got to be serious about how I conduct myself. So that's the basic answer, I guess. I didn't really have a midlife crisis, or if I did have a midlife crisis, it happened in my teens, and it happened in the form of just realizing in a very, very concrete way that I could die at any time, and that I had to therefore be very serious about life and spending my life in a rational way, getting as much out of it as possible, having as much value to my time as possible. And another thing that happens as you grow older is you start thinking about the impact that you're going to have, because, you know, you're not the center of the universe. I'm not the center of the universe. I could, if I wanted to be, pretend like I'm the center of my universe, but that's an absurd way of looking at things. Why? Because you die. Your little universe disappears. And if the only thing that you live for is transient satisfaction of your mortal self, then your life doesn't amount to much in terms of meaning. And I would like to have a life that's significant in the sense that I make a positive impact on the world, or a negative impact on my enemies and their plans, which is to say a positive impact on the world. So I do think more about these sorts of things as I get older. And I look back and I think, gosh, that was a mistake. Or this was a mistake. I wish I had taken all the time I spent reading people like Foucault and Derrida and spent it on something better, right? But these are things that you sort of have to learn through bitter experience. So anyway, that's the first question. And I want to see if there's some questions that have just popped up with the chats over at Entropy and also at the at DLive and Odyssey. So forgive me, folks. I'm just looking. I don't want to overlook anything. Okay, so over at Entropy, we have several questions. Niels has written in with $50. Here, as always, is the monthly donation, as always given in the name of the great god, Ingwe Fryer. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Gadius writes in with $20 without opening the COVID can of worms, which frankly, most are tired of talking about. An interesting discussion between multiple notable people happened this past week on Telegram about liberalism, illiberalism, bodily autonomy, legitimate state powers. What's your takeaway from the debate? Well, I took part in the debate. I've written a number of things on COVID, only two of which I published. Others just sort of went into the notebook and were not published. And the reason why I have hesitated to publish things on COVID or talk about it is because a lot of people have really aberrant, kooky ideas about it. And I did a poll a few weeks ago when I was thinking of writing something on COVID cuckoldry, and how the movement was being cuckolded by people who wanted us to spend our capital on COVID. Before I published that, though, I did this little, a couple of polls. And the numbers were so disturbing that I just thought there's no point in discussing this because it's highly polarizing. It'll split everybody right down the middle. And I'm betting that COVID's going to go away in the coming months. And at a certain point, it'll just be a dead issue. So why talk about a highly polarizing but highly transient issue? Which will be gone in a few months, probably. Discussing it could leave behind permanent scars and bitterness and divisions. And don't we have much more important things to do, like our ongoing struggle against the Great Replacement? So that's my thinking about this. But as COVID has started going away, I've been willing to take in part in some discussions of this in Telegram. Quite some time ago, I said in a live stream that one of the disasters of the right's COVID response was basically it's Alex Jonesization. And by that, I mean two things. Alex Jones pushes forward some extreme conspiratorial thinking about globalists and also population or depopulation, things like that. But he's also a kind of cringe classical liberal. And suddenly I saw vast swaths of our movement echoing these themes, which I think are, you know, not really related to white nationalism, racial nationalism. Liberalism in any form is not compatible with racial collectivism, as I understand it. Liberalism is a highly individualistic philosophy. It ultimately says that there are some things that are more important than the common good, and that those things usually boil down to some form of liberty or equality, or both. And so liberals oftentimes will do very practical things because they're expected to serve the public interest, right? Any functioning society has been set up in certain ways so that the government serves the public interest. That's what it's supposed to do. And of course, this is not entirely inconsistent with liberalism. But the thing that sets liberals apart from political realists of any stripe is that they get these moralistic fixations on somebody's freedom or somebody's equality that suddenly trump all other concerns, including the health of society as a whole. Now, in 2020, we saw this from both sides of the political spectrum. We saw when COVID finally started being taken seriously, and when the left stopped saying, oh, hug a Chinaman and stop being racist and stop closing the borders, and the right was spurred into action as well. We saw people taking actions in the name of the common good, coercive actions, limiting people's liberties, right? It was harder to travel. Social distancing and masks and lockdowns and things like that were being imposed. When the vaccines came out, then there was all these coercive measures to pressure people to get vaccinated. Those were all expressions of emergency powers, public health powers that exist in every liberal democracy and have existed for a very long time. For instance, I remember in 2004, I went off to India, and before I could go to India, I needed to get a visa from the Indian government, and to get a visa from the Indian government, I had to show them that I had been vaccinated against yellow fever, and I believe that I had taken a round of anti-malarial medication. I'm a little hazy on that particular point. I know I took the anti-malarial stuff. I don't know if I was required to show that I'd done so by a doctor. Anyway, that was a vaccine passport, if you will, right? If you've ever traveled to shady, dirty, disease-ridden parts of the world, you've had to get visas and certain vaccinations to do it. Those are powers that governments have had as long as they've had borders, basically, and as long as there have been vaccines against certain communicable diseases. I have a scar from being inoculated as a baby against smallpox. That was not done with my consent. That was a public policy that was imposed upon me. Why? Because getting rid of smallpox was considered to be more important than my liberty as a baby, my consent as a baby. And so, which is a meaningless concept anyway. All of these things are powers that already exist. And these powers are exercised in emergency situations, and they're used coercively against people's liberties. Now, I thought, okay, our government has, first of all, gone into action on this far too late because they're hamstrung by stupid ideas. They were hamstrung by anti-racism from the left, and they were hamstrung by paternalistic concerns for their stock portfolios on the right. Donald Trump was running as a Republican this time for re-election, and he was running on economic good news. And so it was not possible to contemplate economic bad news. And so a lot of people just wanted to ignore this so as to not panic the consumers, right? So we had a very late desultory response to this, which basically allowed the virus to go wild. And I think at that point, things like lockdowns were basically too little too late anyway. A lot of Americans got sick. A lot of Americans died. If you look at the excess death statistics in the last 2 years, last year's full statistics are not published yet, I believe, but there are about 2 million excess deaths in America in the last 2 years. It's almost as if there was a pandemic or something going on, and more people were dying than normally would die. It was serious, pretty serious. Now, what happened, though, when George Floyd expired under the knee of law and order? Suddenly, the left, who were signaling wildly for lockdowns and social distancing and basically everything that Donald Trump hesitated to do for obvious reasons and, selfish reasons, suddenly all of that concern with the public good was put on hold. so that blacks and libs and anarchists could riot and have public tantrums, right? And this is the sort of the liberal instinct. Liberals might go along with good government to a certain point, but then you trigger something and they want to immolate the common good at the foot of some idol, some Moloch, like BLM and the George Floyd cult. Now, liberals of the right do the same crazy shit. There were people on the right, people that I won't even deign to mention, people that I've long since stopped looking at and who are basically dead to me, who were going around basically saying that, no, we shouldn't have any measures at all. It's bad for the economy. And God damn it, I want to go out and eat burgers and be able to sit down in a restaurant and eat my burger. And well, you want to eat your burger. You've got a right to eat your burgers. And I guess you would be quite happy to immolate the public good on the right, your right to eat burgers. There are people on the right who are like that, and they're harmful, frankly. You can't have good government when you've got people who basically will go along with good government until you trigger one of their moralistic fantasies, and then good government, the common good, has to be immolated in front of the Moloch of burgers and pints or riots for George Floyd, stuff like that. That's really what I find objectionable about liberalism. I think freedom and equality are values. I think they're political values. I just think that there's something more important than them, and that when they conflict with the common good of society, they have to give way. That means I'm illiberal. That means I hearken back to classical political theory. Basically, I hearken back to the ideas that have governed the human race before the Enlightenment, before crazy notions of absolute rights. You've got absolute individual rights to do things, and the world should perish rather than trample upon your choice, your freedom of choice. These ideas really only came about in the Enlightenment, and they really only function as moralistic temper tantrums, I wouldn't call them temper tantrums, just moralistic fanaticisms, sort of outbursts of moralistic fanaticism in what's otherwise sort of pragmatic government. And so I think that appealing to liberal principles is not good in two ways. First of all, I think that a public health crisis is a paradigmatic emergency situation where collective measures need to be taken for the collective good. And that would include infringing upon individuals' freedoms to eat burgers, their bodily autonomy, whatever. I think that that's a paradigmatic public crisis that justifies encroaching upon people's liberties. And guess what? Every liberal democracy has these rules because, well, they have to keep society functioning. Okay. Now, that's the first reason. I think emergency powers trampling on individual rights are legitimate. They're part of good government. And second, using liberal arguments against these things from people in our position, I think is self-defeating. Okay, why is it self-defeating? Because I think liberalism is part of the problem. And therefore, using liberal arguments about COVID, appealing to the autonomy of my body, right, or informed consent, basically all of these forms of liberalism boil down to ideas like this. The state doesn't have the right to make you do things that you don't agree to do. Okay, well, I'm sorry, but you can't have a functioning society if that is an absolute principle for you. There are certain circumstances in which you're going to have to be coerced for your own good and for the good of others and for the good of society. And we believe in that kind of stuff. We're racial collectivists. The collective is more important than the individual and his rights. Now, as far as liberty and equality are concerned, my attitude is as much of those as possible, consistent with the common good. No harm, no foul. To that extent, I would endorse somebody like John Stuart Mill's harm principle. As much liberty as you can, provided it doesn't harm society or harm others. And I would even say harm yourself. I believe in a certain amount of paternalism, so that people who want to cut off their genitalia or people who want to stick needles in their arms full of dangerous drugs, we can say no. A decent society says no, you don't have the right to do that. It's your choice, but we're going to stop you from exercising that choice. Decent societies do that. Okay, so affirming liberal principles makes our job harder in the long run, because we don't stand for liberalism. We stand for a form of racial collectivism. Even though we might love liberty and equality, there are things that are more important than liberty and equality to us. And therefore, we're not liberals by the definition of liberalism. And we're certainly not liberals in the modern sense of liberal democracy, and especially in the sense of liberals of the left and the right basically wanting to immolate the common good on the altar of some abstraction, liberty or equality. So it's always some specific form of it that triggers them, whether it's burgers or George Floyd, whatever. They all have their exceptions to the common good. I don't make exceptions for the common good. That's why I'm not a liberal. That's why we shouldn't be liberals. And it just strikes me as short-sighted and self-defeating to use liberal arguments in political contexts then, including the COVID context. Now, I think that the COVID thing is especially a good example of this because it's temporary. It's going to go away. It's already going away. It's not a permanent emergency. Thank God. People are getting tired of it. Eventually, the Italians will want to go back to being singing waiters and having tourists, right? Eventually, everyone is going to want to go back to having fun and normal lives. And in Denmark, they're shutting it down. In Norway and Sweden, they're shutting it down. The UK has shut it down. They're trying to transition back to normal life. People are ready to accept the inevitable, which I talked about 2 years ago, which is that COVID is going to become an endemic disease. It's going to be just another way that people die. And people are just going to have to say, okay, we're going to live with this now. We're going to accept that this is here and not take extraordinary and ineffectual measures to stop it. So anyway, I've used the analogy of the Democrats are the real racists argument. Okay, COVID is a short-term problem. Okay, so why would we use bad arguments to try and pragmatically deal with what is a short-term temporary problem? Why wouldn't we want to use bad arguments? Well, because one of the things that's bedeviling us as a race is the power of liberalism on the minds of our fellow citizens. And in the long run, we need to overthrow the power of liberalism. Therefore, we shouldn't be reinforcing the power of liberalism by trotting out liberal arguments in whatever context, especially a temporary context that people suggest. So for instance, now back to the Democrats are the real racists. We all see that there's something futile about normie conservatives being called racists, because they all get called racists because the left is addicted to that epithet. That stigma, they think if we can just call them racists, they'll roll over and do what we want. And most normie conservatives aren't racists. and they get indignant about this. And then they scan around and they note that people like Tim Wise actually live in virtually all white neighborhoods. And they want to say, oh, look, Tim Wise is the real racist. I'm not a racist. I'm colorblind. Tim Wise is the racist. And I can see why they do that. They are not racists. They're innocent of the charge. And they look and they see their accuser practicing the very thing that he's preaching against, and they want to impeach his credibility. Well, okay, that's understandable. But if you're one of us, you don't want to grant that much credence to the dogma that racism is a bad thing, usually only for white people. And so it's far better if people say, oh, you're the racist, is to say, well, what does racism mean? Right? Instead of dodging it, dodging the accusation, pleading your innocence or whatever, or turning the accusation around at another person, you deal with the underlying premise here, which is the idea that racism is per se evil. That's really the battle that we need to fight. The main political opponent that we have, aside from just liberalism itself, is this stupid dogma that identity politics is bad, but only for white people, and that racism is bad, but only for white people. That's a heinous moral double standard. It's stupid. If we keep playing by these rules, we're going to lose everything, and we are losing. And if we focus on attacking that dogma, that's the smart move. That's the long-term move. And if you just make it about people, well, that's superficial, right? Okay, you can impeach the credibility of Tim Wise all you want. Of course, he's a shameless person. He's always going to come back. But yeah, you might impeach his credibility in the minds of somebody who reads your tweet, right? But it's all just about individuals. The individuals come and go. Tim Wise will be replaced. There's a lot more where Tim Wise came from. Until we overthrow the dogma of anti-racism, we're not going to win. And so we need to focus on the long-term struggle, which is also the struggle over fundamental ideas rather than who is consistent and who's honorable, who's hypocritical, and so forth. I don't generally accuse people of hypocrisy. I don't gleefully accuse people of hypocrisy if they are betraying ideals that I think are false and pernicious. I don't think there's anything wrong with betraying false ideas. That's what we want them to do. It's actually a sign when liberals mate and migrate and behave in a way indistinguishable from members of the Ku Klux Klan, which is a line from Joe Sobran, that's to their credit. It's to their credit. It's a sign of health. It's a sign that they're not completely insane. And I want them to preach what they practice. Not practice what they preach. I want them to preach what they practice. So I'm not going to impeach them and say, you foul hypocrites, you need to marry a Negro and live in a black neighborhood. You foul hypocrites. I'm not going to do that because that's me pretending to be a devotee of a false idea just to flay some nitwit who's actually behaving in a fairly healthy manner. I don't see any long-term benefit from that. I applaud the hypocrisy of my enemies to their false and evil ideas. The only people that I attack as hypocrites are people who have good ideals and should live up to them. Obviously, we want people to live up to good ideals. We don't want them to live up to bad ideals. So hypocrisy, inveighing against hypocrisy in a sort of undistinguishing way is not a good move. It's not a good look for us. Basically, if you treat integrity as an absolute good, That means that it's almost a form of nihilism when you get right down to it. If integrity is an absolute good, that means that you applaud communists for being idealistic communists. Well, I think that's bollocks and bunkum. I think that's terrible. Integrity is not an absolute good if it's integrity to false and destructive ideas. So this is a long answer, and I want to make sure that I'm not missing some things. So let me just collect my thoughts here. So there was a back and forth about liberal ideas between people like Morgoth and Frode Midjord. I believe Joel Davis was involved. Eric Stryker got involved and actually said a couple of surprisingly good things. I think Keith Woods was involved too. And I thought it was a good discussion, honestly. I thought it was all very civil. Imperium Press got involved, and I believe Endeavor got involved. These are all good people. We have differing views on things, and we've exchanged ideas in a pretty civil way. Morgoth has been putting out the following kind of parody of my argument. He quotes me or alludes to me talking about cringe classical liberalism. And he says, it's like a dialogue. I don't want to inject myself with a dangerous and ineffectual substance. And then the response is, that's cringe classical liberalism. Okay, well, that's a kind of a straw man argument, Morgoth. And let me explain to you what's wrong with that. First of all, the argument that's being posed is not a classical liberal argument at all. It's an actual factual argument. And that's where the issue lies. I don't deny the principle that the state can coerce people for the common good and for their own good, especially in a crisis. I don't deny that principle. Where I differ from the current establishment about COVID is on the matters of fact. The vaccines don't work all that well. They're dangerous. The people who are in danger of dying of COVID turn out to be not everybody, but a small percentage of the population. Okay, if everybody were in danger of dying of this, yeah, that would be one thing. It's like vaccinate people. Because COVID is still, the vaccines are still less dangerous than COVID. However, it turns out that not everybody is equally susceptible to COVID. And that basically means that although COVID isn't just the flu, bro, we should treat the COVID vaccine sort of like we treat the seasonal flu vaccine. We do not have hysterical campaigns every flu season to get everybody, including children, to get vaccinated for the flu. And these vaccines are always based on last year's flu, and they're not all that effective anyway. And a certain number of people will die of them because, well, that happens with vaccines all the time. And that's taken into account. That's part of the plan. We don't do that because it's only a risk to old people and sick people. And so we get the old people and the sick people to get the vaccine, and the rest of us go about our lives as normal. The idea that we should take, that healthy people, including myself, should take a vaccine that has risks, but doesn't have any real rewards for us, because there are old people out there who are susceptible to this, is asking too much. It's asking people to take on irrational risks for very little reward to benefit a small minority of people. Let the small minority of people who are at risk take the risks of the vaccines. Don't force it on everybody else. Those are the kinds of arguments that need to be made, not arguments about bodily autonomy and things like that, or informed consent. These things are out of place in a health crisis, and people don't even listen to that. They tune it out. They tune it out because they take the crisis seriously. If you want to change people's thinking, you got to get them to take the crisis less seriously. if it can be taken less seriously. And what we've got with COVID is really a combination of a number of things. We have the left addicted to social signaling and righteousness. They're the last ones who are going to give up on this. The polls are out. I predicted this 2 years ago. Eventually, as COVID unwinds, the people on the right will jump the gun and want to unwind it too soon because they have a bias in favor of gross domestic product and normality. Whereas the left, which is addicted to social signaling and addicted to righteous indignation and addicted to feeling virtuous and public-spirited, will be the last ones to let it go. And the polls are showing this. The people on the right want it over with. The centrists, they want it over with too, overwhelmingly. And it's the left that are going to cling to this, to the very dead end. Okay. That's just predictable, right? And another factor, though, is not ideology and moralism. It's simply corruption. Part of liberalism is denying that there is a common good of society, or denying that it matters, or denying that we can know it. And so what it inculcates is the idea that, well, I guess everybody just needs to look out for himself, and somehow the magic of the marketplace will work so it works out okay for everybody. That's very much the ethos of liberalism. If there is no common good in normal circumstances, what does that mean? Well, it means that you have to look out for your own interests. If you look out for your own interests, well, what does that imply for politics? Well, political statesmen in the classical sense are supposed to think about what's good for the country as a whole. Most politicians in America are only thinking about their own interests, and they feel that that's not even corruption. They feel that that's not even a falling off from what a politician should do, because in their heart of hearts, they're liberals, and ultimately what's real for them is only self-interest. So what is that ideological fixation, that moral code of liberalism, lead to in the practice of government? It leads to wholesale corruption, because what you've got is you've got a bunch of self-seeking careerists who are basically selling legislation to the highest bidder. We now have a government, or many governments actually, where you have significant numbers of people who are just bought by the pharmaceutical industry to push their junk on people, their profitable junk. And they don't feel any deep problem about this, because this is very close to the default mentality that liberalism inculcates anyway. That's one of the reasons why we have to get rid of this horrible fixation. Because people accept this worldview, we have wholesale corruption and lack of seriousness in the highest places in our countries, even in a crisis. In a serious country, we would not have behaved the way that we behaved. A serious country would have behaved like China, frankly. The Chinese reacted to COVID like they'd been hit with a bioweapon. And I think they were. I think they were probably right about that. But that's another discussion to have. The Chinese and other East Asian societies are sufficiently collectivist, not individualist, not liberal, and they could move much more in tune with one another to close borders and shut this down. And they're still very, very concerned with not letting it in. I have a friend who was telling me about going to Thailand. You have to quarantine for a week or 10 days, right? They're very serious over there. And because they're collectivist, they're good at reacting to these things, whereas the West is individualist and liberal and could not put together serious policies in a short enough period of time. And the policies that did get created are just a horrible compromise put together by a lot of people who are simply corrupt, simply corrupt and looking out for their own goods and the goods of factional interests, including things like the pharmaceutical business or Wall Street or whatever. That is the price we pay for liberalism, and that's why we shouldn't feed that monster. Anyway, this has been a long answer. So let's, you got your 20 bucks worth, Gadius. So let's go to entropy, and I'm going to hit refresh and see if there's some more questions here. Okay, so Scott writes in with two $20 questions. After the 2020 elections, you tweeted that some people in our movement are sour at Nick Fuentes because he is successful while they languish on obscure blogs. I agree with you. Nick has disavowed us as Wignats, but Matt Heimbach did the same thing last year and no one seemed to care as much. Okay, this is true. I do think that there were many people sour about and still sour at Nick Fuentes because they want to be Nick Fuentes. I think Richard Spencer really wants to be Nick Fuentes, and he's really, really salty that he's not Nick Fuentes. That's a factor, definitely. Okay, now Scott sends another 20 bucks, and he says this. People who advocate big tent nationalism are the first to accuse others of purity spiraling because it excludes people from the movement. But if you reject big tent nationalism, the big tent nationalists don't want anything to do with you either because you're being divisive. Both positions are exclusionary. Yeah, I would agree with that. Both positions are exclusionary. However, I am one of these people who believes in big tent nationalism. But I also believe that if you have a big tent, you can't really exclude people from it. And there are going to be a lot of people under that big tent who are basically going to be selfish operators who are out to benefit themselves at the expense of the greater movement. So, for instance, I gave a speech in Stockholm a few years ago on how to make our ideas mainstream. And the way to make our ideas mainstream, basically, is to find ways of appealing to every possible white constituency and change their minds. Okay. What kind of movement can do that? Well, a movement that can interface with every white constituency and pull them in our direction. So the way I envision an effective movement is very pluralistic and very large, and a movement that can appeal to lots of different groups. Now, the opposite of that kind of movement is the sort of sectarian movement. And this is the term that I've been using for a while. I've written a couple pieces. One is called Against Right-Wing Sectarianism, and the other is basically this piece on changing the mainstream, making our ideas mainstream. Sectarianism is basically this. A big tent movement can be united by the desire to promote white survival, stop the Great Replacement. That's a pretty important goal. In fact, I think it's the most important goal there is. And that can unite us. Now, how does sectarianism come in? Well, sectarianism is always about the add-on items. We're for white survival and Christ is king. We're for white survival and no tattoos. We're for white survival, but if you drink coffee, not tea, we're going to look down our nose at you. We're for white survival plus maximum COVID conspiratorialism. We're for white survival plus Holocaust revisionism and stuff like that. And if you want to do that, it's easy. It's a simple trick. What you do is you see this big tent and it's full of people and they're all gathered to there because they're concerned about the future of the white race. And you go in there as an operator and you think, how can I win some of these people over to me? How can I split this group off and bring them over to my little sub-tent and get them paying for my stuff, right? Well, you come up with a wedge issue. You're all there because you're concerned about the future of the white race. So you've got to come up with a wedge issue that separates the people that you want to bring over as followers from the other guys. So you go hard on the Christianity thing because that's a big wedge issue. or you go hard on, I don't know, diet fads or whatever. You're going to be vegan nationalists or whatever. It's usually something connected with interwar fascism, the Holocaust, hating women, and Christianity. These are like the big sectarian wedge issues that people use. And the reason why they do that is that they want to have a smaller subset of the movement that is fanatically attuned to them and their will. They want pay pigs, basically. They want foot soldiers and pay pigs. And the only thing that I can do as a big tent nationalist is just identify the pattern and put it out there. I can't stop these people. I can't exclude these people. I can't exclude these people from the internet. I can't stop these people. I can only observe that when the movement was larger and people were less concerned with, basically wrangling little herds of pay pigs around and separating their brands and things like that from one another, and more just focused on the struggle, it was a beautiful thing. I'm thinking of the alt-right circa 2015, 2016, before Richard Spencer tried to take it over, basically. That was a beautiful thing. And the thing about it was that it was a lot of independent actors, a lot of anonymous people, a lot of small groups, but mostly independent actors, just networked together through the web, who were exchanging ideas and exchanging memes and coordinating various activities. And there was an order that emerged that was beautiful. The movement was bigger than any of the participants. It was a beautiful thing. The sectarian goy wranglers, the pay pig farmers, they don't want a movement that's bigger than them. They want a movement that fits within the parameters of their goals and their limited mentality. And any individual's mind is limited compared to the intelligence that you can see that emerges, the creativity that emerges when you have many, 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 many independent actors working together, cooperating like we did before the movement fell apart. So you can't exclude people who do this, but you can identify that they're selfish and they're destructive. And that's all I can say. The advocates of big tent nationalism over purity spiraling and sectarianism are exclusionary in the sense that we believe that our way is right, and we would wish that other people would hew to it. But we can't exclude these people because we're realistic. We're realistic. You can't purge people from the internet. Not even our government can do that. Not yet. The best you can do is simply alert people to the pig farmers' way of going about things and get them angry when they suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm just being basically herded around as a pay pig in increasingly sectarian purity spirals. There are people who make businesses and make reputations from simply engaging in one sectarian squabble after another. The list is actually so long that it's impossible to name names. So anyway, let's look at some of the people in the chat here on Entropy. Not Entropy. Well, let's go to Odyssey, first of all. Nick did the Christianity thing and his movement is full of non-whites. Well, yes, because if it's essential that Christ is king, well, any person of any race can be washed in the blood of the Lamb, right? Okay, so Suburban Elk says, situation in Canada is making America look like a bunch of hosers. This is good. This is true. I like that. I think the trucker rebellion is a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful working class thing, and I hope it spreads everywhere. And it makes me so happy that it's happening in Canada. Half my family's Canadian. I look upon Canada with great fondness. So anyway, I'm proud of the Canadians, especially the Western Canadians. That's where my family harkens from. And they've always despised Ottawa and liberalism and that stupid Canadian flag, the corporate logo with the maple leaf on it. That was adopted in the 1960s to erase the ethnic heritage of the Canadian nation from its flag. Globalism and multiculturalism were, you know, adopted very early in Canada by the Ottawa regime, and it's a very bad thing. And people who are fighting against it, I admire them quite a lot. Okay, so let's look at the folks over at DLive. Okay, Hadrian was right, donated one diamond. Hadrian was right about a lot of things. One lemon donator has donated one lemon. I'm hoping that one Ninjagini donator will be showing up soon. Slog has donated 14 lemons. Critique donated one ice cream. Alaska Chaga, one Ninjagini. Did you see any potential in some of the new innovations coming from AltTech, such as GabPay? I actually tried to upgrade. Well, I actually tried to become a Gab Pro member yesterday, and GabPay crapped out on me. So I think it needs a little bit of work, but I'm really hopeful. And I'm going to try again. I'm going to try and upgrade my Gab membership. Okay. Okay. So let's look at some of these comments here. It could be that Thailand has been paid handsomely by the World Economic Forum. Okay. This is one of the things where I disagree with people. Strongly. About 50% of the people who responded to my poll don't believe that there are basically different governments and power blocks competing with one another in the world. They think that everything is being controlled top down by a tiny cabal of globalists. And I just don't live in that world. I don't think that world is real. Okay. Salty dog, I don't believe COVID exists. Well, I disagree with you on that, fellow. Norse nature, many opportunists have definitely taken full advantage of COVID. Absolutely. This is true. People have taken advantage of it. I still think it's real. Okay. The extremely maximalist, heavy breathing conspiracy theories that have come up around COVID are ultimately premised on denying that it's real in the first place. Okay. That's in this sense. A lot of people just started out denying that it was real. Well, if you don't think it's real and the world is running around in a panic, then you've got to come up with an explanation for why they're doing this. And so it's a massive power grab of powers that the government's already had. Things like that. I never bought that it wasn't real, and therefore I never needed some heavy breathing conspiracy theories to explain what was going on. There was a real problem, and you could see different governments in different parts of the world reacting to it in pretty much the ways that you could predict based on their ethnicity and ideology. That's how it's borne out. And unfortunately, in the West, because we're so individualistic and liberal, we've reacted to it extremely badly. And I think the people in the Far East have reacted to it more maturely and better and more effectively. So lockdowns aren't quarantines. Well, sort of they are. Basically what lockdowns are is just extreme social distancing for everyone at all time. Big tent nationalism is positive and has been tested in much political cross-pollination between nationalism and other groups during COVID. Okay. Maybe. Okay, Greg's right about Spencer wanting to be Fuentes. Thing is, Fuentes wants to be Charlie Kirk. Well, if Fuentes wants to be Charlie Kirk, that would explain the direction he's going, yeah. Spencer wants to be Fuentes, but Fuentes is Spencer. There's some truth there. GLV writes, dissident figure elevated to prominence, gone insane from minor celebrity. Yes, there's definitely a pattern there. Gadius says he wants to be Varg. I think that's rather cool, actually. Norse nature. Personally, I think Nick Fuentes has too many character flaws to be important long-term. I would agree with that. I think that he's just going to burn out and fall apart very much in the same way that Richard Spencer did. I think that he's much more talented than Richard Spencer. I don't think that he's got a severe alcohol or drug problem, which was a real handicap for Spencer, definitely. But I think he's got a lot of the same bad personality traits. And that means that eventually what's going to happen is he's going to be mean to people around him and they're going to start revealing things, that kind of stuff. That's how it happens. Generally, you know, the prickly megalomaniac leader who just doesn't feel like he needs to be nice to people is mean to the wrong person, somebody he actually depends upon. And then things start falling apart. Eventually, people back out of the room, people don't want to defend them. So the thing just collapses. I think that'll happen probably with him eventually. There's nothing I can do to speed that along or stop it because I don't have the power to, and I don't care. I haven't watched anything that Nick Fuentes has broadcast in a couple of years. I think I've watched maybe 2 hours total of anything he's ever said. So it's really not in my hands. And this goes back to the very first question. Life's short and I just don't have time for this stuff. And the idea of hanging on the words of this guy, how many hours a week does he broadcast? Sorry, life's too short. Okay, so let me find a few more people here. Fuentes' charisma and intelligence, but he's far too young. Yeah, I mean, I have sort of gotten to this attitude after seeing a lot of really promising people who are young emerge during the alt-right era and then flame out or disappear. It's very disappointing. A lot of people just didn't have staying power. And my feeling is that you just can't trust anybody under 30 when you get right down to it. And if you are under 30 and you think that's a bad thing, well, you can always change my mind. So that would be fine. Yeah, Reed Johnson writes, Fuentes is too weak on race as well. His brand of Catholic anti-racism, is a brand of Catholic anti-racialism. That's a problem. Yeah, I agree with that. Well, I hope that he mobilizes a millennial cell. Nick himself will turn into an Alex Jones-like character, but behind the scenes, Nick is affecting young guys entering political life. I think there's probably a truth to that. Yeah, so I'm just going to move forward here. There are some more questions at Entropy. This is a related question. Sutton asks, what did I think of the phone call that with Richard Spencer that Nick Fuentes leaked a while ago? Do I care to comment on that? Yeah, sure. I listened to it. It was very, very entertaining. It's sort of cringe entertainment. No, it made Spencer look insane and pathetic, but it made Fuentes look bad too, frankly. I thought both of them looked bad because of that. There's a lesson there, I guess. Ted and Alice write in. Say hi to Bob and Carol for me. What are your thoughts on the Whoopi Goldberg controversy? Well, I don't have any particularly original thoughts on it, so I can be very brief. Whoopi Goldberg said that the Holocaust wasn't about race, but about inhumanity because, well, it was just white people fighting with one another. So it wasn't a racial thing. And she's been suspended from The View and people have been attacking her. She's being schooled by the ADL. Now, I thought this was beautiful. This was very, very useful to us. And it shows that our enemies, sadly, we have to hope that our enemies defeat themselves. You know, I'm sick of having to wait for our enemies to defeat themselves. I just like to outright defeat them on our own. But when they do something self-defeating, it's manna from heaven. I do appreciate it. It's self-defeating for Jews to attack a black woman and on the grounds that Jews aren't white people. Okay, if they want to proclaim to the high heavens that Jews aren't white people, that's extremely useful because generally the way Jews work is if it's convenient for them, they're white people, right? This is where we get the endless, hilarious fellow white people tweet pairings that happen. They like to pretend to be white when they want to harm white people, when they want to be Judas goats leading us to destruction. They're white. And then they're Jews when it suits them. And here they are attacking on the first day of Black History Month, a prominent black woman for being politically incorrect and thinking that they're white people. Well, you know, in her defense, she could cite thousands of tweets where Jews are saying, my fellow white people need to be more tolerant, right? My fellow white people have been marinated in evil and prejudice and privilege since the day we were born. She could just cite thousands and thousands of tweets where Jews are saying that they're white people. This is extremely useful to us. It's I'm sure it makes certain black people open their eyes and take note. I think it's a very interesting argument. Maybe the reason why they jumped on her is because of what follows from it. If the Holocaust was just a bunch of white people, crazy ass white people, as she might say in her earthy way, crazy ass white people going at it with one another, what does that matter to me, right? What does that matter to black people? The Holocaust is just crazy-ass white people killing each other. That doesn't matter to black people. That is causing the black Jewish coalition to tremble a little bit. And that's overthrowing the sanctity of the Holocaust. So this is an extremely useful thing, and the reactions are golden. It's especially disgusting to see normie cons suddenly demanding that there be more canceling going on. They always do this, especially when Jews are involved. They always become more Catholic than the Pope about things that they normally complain about. Suddenly, cancel culture is a good thing when they can try and show that that ABC is being hypocritical. Again, this is the Dems are the real racist kind of stuff. The short-sightedness of that is absurd, but most people are short-sighted. The bell curve, there's a bell curve, right, of time horizons. And even most white people are short-sighted. Okay, so that was a brief answer. Well, I hope it was brief. I wanted it to be brief. Mr. Trenchcoat Guy writes in with $5. Is Dr. Johnson thinking about possibilities for a countercurrent youth outreach program? Actually, no. No, I'm not thinking about youth outreach. I'm actually thinking about becoming completely indifferent to the youth and not courting the youth at all. I think the youth need to make themselves, instead of courting the youth, I want the youth to court countercurrents. I want them to impress me and impress the other people around here. If you're 19 years old and think you're a genius and you've got great ideas to save the white race, go ahead and impress me. Reach out to us. I'm not going to reach out to you. I'm not going to cater to you. I don't know the first thing. I swear, kids today, I don't understand them. I was running hard to catch up with stuff back in 2014, 2015. Now it's just, I've grown older and there's a new cohort of kids out there who are wrapped up in stuff that I find completely baffling. So yeah, I wouldn't know how to court the youth, and I don't think we should. There's something about modernity, the idea of the noble savage, of the innocence of youth, that we need to question. We need to reject that. Children and young people are barbarians. and they need to be educated or they'll destroy society. And unfortunately, they've been so badly educated or not educated at all, including guys who come to the right, that they rush through Gab like hooligans, sacking the place. They're barbarians. And I don't think we should court barbarians. I think that we should uphold standards of civility and intelligence and seriousness and hope that they can maybe take note and emulate that. And maybe some of them, if they think they can impress us, will reach out to us. But I'm not going to reach out to them. Neon Noir writes in, 7, Greg, what happened with you and Spencer? He recently mentioned you as a spiteful person on Politically Provoked. Also, you should go on Politically Provoked. What happened with you and Spencer? Well, basically, it's not really all that personal. And I know people like to say, oh, it's personal. There's some personal thing. And there, how did Richard break your heart? That kind of thing. You know, people love to personalize disagreements. It's not all that personal. I just think that the main thing, the thing that led me to publicly break with him. Okay. My initial impression was, he's not all that impressive. I thought other people were way too impressed with him. I thought he was somewhat shallow. I thought he was a poor writer. And I didn't find him all that charming, but then I didn't have anything he wanted. So he was not particularly charming to me. But I wasn't that impressed with him. Then after this was in 2009, I think, when I first met him, 2008, 2009. In 2010, I started Countercurrents. He started Alternative Right. I wanted him to be a colleague, right? I wanted to be collegial, but I wasn't all that impressed. I think at the beginning of 2012, I decided I actually created a document. I'm sure I have it still, called Charm Offensive. And it was just a list of people that I wanted to be more cordial with and have more of a working relationship with. And Spencer was one of the people on that list. And so he came to a Countercurrents retreat. I spent some time talking with him when I visited Montana in 2013, I think it was, in 2014. And especially in 2013, when I spent time with him, I thought, you know, he's not as shallow as I thought. Right. I think his writing is very, very shallow and slapdash. But I didn't think he was shallow as the impression that he had given me. But the thing that really made me just wash my hands of him was when he had this conference in Budapest, Hungary in 2014. And it was shut down by the government, and he vowed defiance that he was going to go there and have the conference anyway, even though the hotel had pulled out, people's rooms were canceled, etc. He was not communicating with people who didn't know whether to fly in or not. And one of the things that he kept secret, it was that Bill Regnery, the president of NPI, had flown in and to the conference and was picked up at the airport in Budapest, deported from the country and banned from entering Europe or the Schengen zone for 3 years. Now, I thought that was a relevant piece of information that should have been shared with every American who was flying in there, because every American who was flying in there was known to the government because they had access to the people who registered at the hotel. So they canceled everybody's registrations. They had the names of all the people who were coming to the conference, and they were watching for Americans who showed up. And he did not tell people about this. I know one guy who got arrested and deported and banned from Schengen for 3 years, and he actually lived in Europe and was married to a European woman and had a child with her. He had to go through all kinds of legal battles over this. Before I decided I wasn't going to risk going to it, I heard about this through private channels, basically people who were involved in the conference planning. I publicized this and I warned people to stay away. I thought that's what Spencer should have done 2 days before. He should have warned Americans not to go because they could have been arrested, deported, and banned from the Schengen zone for 3 years. He hid that fact because he wanted people to go so the conference could happen in some form or another while he was going to try and improvise a rabbit out of a hat. He managed to sneak into the country, went around giving interviews to the press, and was eventually, because he's addicted to that, and eventually he was deported from the country and banned for 3 years from Schengen. Anyway, I just thought his behavior was so unethical that I blew the whistle on him, and the fucker called me a liar in public. And that was it. You know, nobody comes back from that kind of behavior with me. I just thought there's no point in keeping this guy around. He's obviously a narcissist, deceitful, and lacking in sympathy for other people. He's sociopathic. And you can't have somebody like that running an organization, especially somebody who's shown a complete disregard for the privacy rights and the, you know, just the personal interests of the people who are coming to his events. So I just wrote him off at that point, and I warned people publicly about this. And very few people took it seriously, sad to say. I've had a few temptations, which I bit back on, to say, I told you so. After Hailgate, I actually did say, well, I did tell you so to a couple of people. But, you know, he's a guy with bad character, and character is destiny. And there's a lesson for all the people who are investing a lot in Nick Fuentes, because he's basically cut from the same kind of cloth. He's just smarter and more talented, but he's basically got the same kinds of flaws. So the same kind of results will happen eventually. And he's not going to be around to pick you up or help you out, because he doesn't feel solidarity with other human beings the way normal people do. Okay. He's a user. So anyway, that's what happened. And if you want to call that spiteful or not, I don't care. Okay. So that's basically the Spencer story. So let's see if we have some more people who are sending in DLive tokens, and I will thank you and respond. Folks, we have run out of DLive tokens. So send some more in, please. I would very much appreciate that. Let's go over to Odyssey and see if there is new stuff at Odyssey to talk about. Okay, I don't seem to see any questions here, but there are some good comments. So thank you very much, folks. Let's just see if there are some questions or comments here in the chat at Entropy. Oh, Norse Nature has donated one diamond. Thanks for the show, Greg. Well, thank you for the diamond. If we keep doing what we're doing, the right youth of talent and promise will come to us. Exactly. Let them to come to us. Build something inspiring. Build something edifying. And let them come to us. Don't pander to the youth. They're barbarians. I mean, by their very nature, right? They lack culture and knowledge. And any society that caters to people who lack culture and knowledge is basically working in reverse. It's got its priorities absolutely in reverse. The people who lack culture and knowledge should be trying to impress the people who do have it. They should be trying to improve themselves. But instead of having a society where we edify people and demand that they improve, we have a society that caters to the immaturity of the youth and flatters them in it and confirms them in it. And that's as much true on the right as it is on the left, I'm afraid to say. Norse Nature says it's pretty easy to disagree with Richard these days. Bastard of Modernity said, Rich Spencer didn't break my heart. He's just an asshole. Millennial Cell, I strongly believe he's a contrarian. No matter how much he says he isn't, I don't think he has a coherent ideology. I think that's about Richard. He loves to be hated. Well, you know, he would love to be loved, but if he can't be loved, he wants to be hated because he wants to be the center of attention. And that's just sort of a pathological narcissist behavior pattern. Spencerism is tough to get if you don't understand that he considers the center right a bigger enemy than the left. This is true. He was fired after a few months from a job at the American Conservative. And it's tempting to just sort of dismiss it as something shallow as sour grapes, but he probably got fired because of these attitudes. But he's always despised conservatives. And he has this little routine that he would go through that really got him backed into some really stupid positions like ethical child porn and stuff like that. Basically, what he does is he tries to divine what his natural constituency, and that means people right of center, would believe on an issue, and then come up with some big-brained take where he's going to try and arrive at a left liberal position somehow based on rightist premises. It's just a game. It's a silly game, and it's a tiresome game, so I just stopped listening to him play it. Okay, so anyway, let's see if there are any non-Spencer-related comments here. The youth pastor is the incarnation of this indulgence of the youth. Well, I don't know if the youth maybe. I mean, the youth pastor is at least trying to lead them to some kind of higher truth, I would assume. It's the culture industry that is the epitome of that. It's entertainment, games, pop culture. Yeah, that kind of stuff. That's really the great indulger of the youth. And it indulges people and confirms people in their ignorance, makes them feel satisfied to be ignorant. And that's deeply destructive of culture and civilization. Okay, got a couple more questions here. Let's see. Gallant Magister, I hope that's pronounced right. Gallant Magister, what are your thoughts on the ADL's changing definition of racism? Oh, this is beautiful. The ADL has royally screwed up twice in 1 week. The ADL used to have a fairly conventional definition of racism that most people, even people like me, could sign off on, which is something to the effect that it's a belief that some groups are inherently better or worse than others, something like that. I think that's sort of off target, but the new, because it's not about inferiority, it's really about difference. Racism in its rational sense is basically the natural, normal preference that people have for others of their own kind, defined racially primarily, but it can also be more finely divided in terms of ethnicity and so forth. That's what's being stigmatized with this term racism. Natural, normal, love of one's own, preference for those who are genetically similar to one. Now, what they did is they changed that to mean to a definition of racism as something that only white people can inflict, right? So it's basically they changed the critical race theory thing. So we've been saying for years that the ADL is an anti-white organization, and they put it right on their website. They're anti-white. I love it. And it's in the same week that they declared that they're not white people, they also come out and say that racism is only a white thing. And that presumably Jews then therefore can't be racists, or black people can't be racists. Only white people can be racist. And then they got pushback and they took it down, which is even more interesting. And we should be emboldened by this. When the enemy actually wavers, that's when you start piling on, right? This was an incredibly stupid move on their part to put that definition up there, and even stupider to pull it down. And the wavering that's going on there should be encouraging to us all. The left, the establishment, especially Jewish groups like the ADL, are really worried right now because all of their attempts to censor, all of their attempts to dominate the national conversation, to push their narrative, are failing. People are radicalizing. Millions and millions of Americans now hold views that only white nationalists held 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. This is remarkable. And all of the efforts of groups like the ADL and the SPLC, all of the efforts of the mainstream legacy media, of academia, et cetera, to stop this are failing. In fact, they're backfiring. And so they're really freaking out. And the fact that they flinched on this is an interesting sign of lack of self-confidence within the enemy ranks, at the very highest levels of the enemy ranks. The ADL is probably more important than the U.S. Congress in a lot of ways. And if these people are flinching, that's an interesting sign. That's a sign of weakness at the very heart of the establishment. And when they show weakness, when there's blood in the water, that's when people start moving against them. I think it's very interesting. So this is a sign of many interesting things to come. Okay, let's see here. One lemon donator has donated one lemon. Thank you. BMA, Big Mac A donated one diamond. Keep up the good work. Greg from an Irish friend. That's great. You know, I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of listeners in Ireland, and I love Ireland. I haven't visited yet, but I love Ireland, and I will visit there eventually. Nick says, I don't know how it's possible, but Greg sounds younger as time goes by. That's interesting. It's the hate. It's the hate that keeps me young. What's the line from Milton in Paradise Lost, where Satan talks about immortal hate? Really great. I'm Googling it. The unconquerable will and study of revenge, immortal hate, and courage never to submit or yield. I love those lines. So it keeps you young, friends. That's my secret. That and fish oil. Okay. And not smoking. Not smoking and drinking. Do that for half your, or practically your entire life, and does keep you younger. So anyway, okay, I got another question here. This is from Seeley. Seeley has two questions. What do globalists want? And what's the difference between globalists and imperialists? That's a really interesting pair of questions. What do globalists want? I want to give, I like both Irelands, by the way, folks. The Republic and Northern Ireland. Okay, I've got friends in both places. Okay, so let's talk about what the globalists want. I want to give a reasonable interpretation of globalism first, okay? Because I think there's a reasonable argument to be made for it. People are drawn into this because there are arguments for it. So what does globalism promise? Well, globalism promises peace and prosperity. Basically, that's what globalism promises. They look at nations, and nations have wars occasionally. Sometimes these wars grow very, very big and destructive. They're terribly destructive of human life. They're destructive of civilization. They waste progress and so on and so forth. Wouldn't it be nice if we could find ways of avoiding war? And instead of having wars, promote cooperation between different societies. That presupposes that there's certain people in every society who are attached not to the parochial interests of their societies, but to the larger interests, say the interests of the globe, the interests of humanity, the interests of the whole world. They want not to be narrowly sectarian or narrowly patriotic. They want to be cosmopolitan. They want the cosmos or the globe to be their community, not their nation state. And so they find one another, basically. They advertise their views, they find other people like them, and they create organizations, international, intergovernmental organizations that seek to promote cooperation between different nations and to mediate and prevent conflict. So that's what they want. That's what globalists want. They want peace and prosperity. And they want peace and prosperity and order in the world. And they believe that the way to do that is to step outside one's narrow nationalistic and parochial outlooks and think about the bigger picture, think about the global interest. And they claim that that's what they're really thinking. That's what they're really doing. Now, the trouble is that these global institutions are susceptible to a kind of tribalism of their own. First of all, cosmopolitans around the world have started becoming their own tribe. And I'm not using code word for Jews, okay? Although people have used that as a code word for Jews, cosmopolitans, rootless cosmopolitans. Cosmopolitans are basically any urban bugmen that you can think of who think of themselves as citizens of the world and anti-nationalist and so forth. They have become their own tribe, and they feel comfortable around one another, and they feel contempt for their own countrymen. And it is a problem to give power to people who hold you in contempt. Isn't it better to return their contempt in kind? And so this is one of the reasons why globalists are not trusted, because they pretend, they aspire. Let's say they sincerely aspire to be above tribe and nation, and yet they become their own kind of tribe. And they aspire to be above hostility that goes along with tribalism, yet they have their tribal hostility towards basically all the normies of the planet, right? So they're just repeating on a higher level with a whole bunch of bad faith the problems that they profess to be overcoming. Now, the other problem with globalism is that it is just captured by enemy tribes. And there's one particular one that I can think of. Jews are overrepresented in these globalist institutions because, well, it helps them be an international people. It helps them get easy entry and easy exit from societies, easy entry so they can get good stuff, and easy exit when the natives catch on and want to chase them out, which means they need easy entry to somewhere else. They have really captured a lot of these institutions and subverted them. And so they've been subverted to tribal interests, and they are tools of tribal hostility towards the rest of the world. That's sort of the long and the short of it. I mean, that's kind of a short version of what's wrong with globalism. There needs to be something like globalism, something like cosmopolitanism on some level. Why? Because there really are global problems that need global solutions and that require cooperation amongst different governments, different sovereign states. And so they need to come together and work on these things. But for these things to actually be able to work, they have to not be captured by tribal groups and become tools, instruments of tribal hostility. And you can pretty much argue that every global institution today is simply one of these tools of tribal hostility versus the cosmopolitan tribe or the Jewish tribe or whatever other group manages to hollow out and take over these international institutions. So there's a piece that I wrote at Countercurrents, and I hope somebody will link it in the chat. It's called Lessing's Ideal Conservative Freemasonry. That's a mouthful. Lessing. Lessing was an 18th century German writer who wrote a work called Ernst und Falk on Freemasonry. And I wrote an essay on it because I think it's absolutely profound, this dialogue. And he makes a case for a kind of conservative Freemasonry. And by conservative, I mean nationalist as well as conservative. And his argument is basically this, that for any society to work, there have to be people in the society who are willing to look past their class interests for the greater good of society. Okay, we grant that. That's a classic problem of political philosophy. Well, how are we to deal with global problems such as wars and things like that? Well, there have to be people within every nation who are willing to look past their national interests and think about the interests of the whole world. And he suggests that this is what Freemasonry in an ideal sense, not the actual sense, but the ideal sense, sort of a hypothetical Freemasonry would be. And of course, Freemasonry is one of the global institutions, right? It's one of these international societies. So I think there's a valid argument there. We need to have international cooperation. We need to have people who take into account the welfare of the whole world. And to make these things work, though, we have to prevent these from being captured by tribes, new tribes or old, and turned into tools of tribal hostility towards the normies of the world. Okay, so what's the difference between globalists and imperialists? Well, there's not that big a difference because the main argument for imperialism is we will bring peace and prosperity to warring tribes. Globalism is just the widest form of imperialism. If you look, there's a wonderful book. It's really the first surviving historical novel. It was written by an Athenian named Xenophon. It's called The Education of Cyrus. And it's a historical novel about Cyrus the Great, the creator of the Persian Empire. And it's an interesting sort of political allegory. It's a history, or quasi-history. It's a novel, but it communicates political philosophy. And one of the things that Xenophon communicates in this book is the ideology of the Persian Empire. Cyrus was known as the Prince of Peace, which was an epithet, a compliment that was later taken up by Jesus, right? He was the Prince of Peace. Why? Because wherever he went, he conquered warring peoples and forced them to be at peace with one another, and then brokered mutually advantageous commercial interactions between these people who could never get along. And he brought peace to a vast part of the world, the largest empire to date. So that is basically the ideology of empire, and it's also the root idea of globalism. We need some power that overawes the different nations of the world to compel them to stop fighting and start trading with one another and start cooperating with one another. So that's it. Now I have another question. I got some short questions here. Bentham writes in, have you stopped reviewing movies at UNS? Yeah, I stopped reviewing movies at UNS at the end of last year. The reason for that is simply this. I'm on good terms with Ron Unz. I think he's doing great work. I just wanted to focus on writing a book, which I'm working on now, which is called The Great Replacement, and that'll be out in the fall. So I just needed to focus my energies on political writing rather than movie reviews, even though I love writing movie reviews. And I was really flattered that Ron wanted me writing movie reviews, and I did it for 2 years, and I wrote almost 2 entire books. The 5th volume of my movie essays is going to be coming out in the spring sometime after I get this Francis Parker Yockey book to press. It's called Trevor Lynch's Classics of Right-Wing Cinema. So you can look forward to that in the spring. I want to go to Eric. Eric, a couple weeks ago, asked, this is when I had Greg Hood on, or Kevin Deanna. I can't remember what name he's using now. asked about our favorite fantasy novels or films, and I just didn't get to the question. Well, I'll answer that, and I apologize for forgetting at the time. So, Eric, my favorite fantasy novels are Lord of the Rings. I don't read a lot of fantasy, first of all. I don't read a lot of science fiction or fantasy. I don't read a lot of literature, to be perfectly honest. I read mostly nonfiction stuff. But I do love The Lord of the Rings. I love the book, and I love the films. I think the films are absolutely fantastic films. Another novel that I really love that straddles science fiction and fantasy is Dune. I think it's a magnificent book. And I reread that every few years. I probably reread Dune more than I reread any other book, which is maybe something to be a little bashful about, but it's true. I just find myself drawn back to it because it's a fascinating book and it's actually rather deep. Now, there are several film adaptations of Dune, and the best of those is David Lynch's. And I've reviewed all the different Dune adaptations. There are three now. And you can read those under the byline, the pen name Trevor Lynch over at Countercurrents. So I'm not a big fan of the Denis Villeneuve Dune, although I was hoping it would be really good. I'm afraid Lynch's still rules, even though it's a flawed movie and weird in so many ways, and takes some liberties with the story, definitely. So let's see here. Marion asked to recommend some novels that I have read or that I have reread or will reread because they're so good. So I thought that was an interesting question. If you want to jot some of these down, folks, these are the ones that I've reread and will reread. Well, the first one, I guess, is Dune and then Lord of the Rings. I already mentioned those. I love Dostoevsky, The Brothers Karamazov, Crime and Punishment, The Devils or Demons, however it's translated. Those are fabulous novels. Victor Hugo's Notre Dame de Paris, often called The Hunchback of Notre Dame, I think is an absolutely perfect novel. It's superb. I really love Mishima's The Sound of Waves. It's just a charming book. And another book by him that's incredibly dark and nihilistic, but I have reread, is The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea. Lampedusa's novel, The Leopard, I've only read once, but I plan to reread it. I think it's an absolutely fabulous book. D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love, I think, is a great novel of ideas. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, fabulous book. I've reread The Fountainhead, Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, a number of times, and I do still like it, even though I'm not a libertarian by a long shot. And I also recommend Flannery O'Connor's novel, Wise Blood. I've reread that a number of times, and I want to go back to it again. Okay, let's see if there are some more questions at Entropy. I'm not seeing any new Entropy questions. So let's, folks, if you want me to answer some more questions, talk to you some more for the next 15 minutes, send me some questions. Send them here at DLive, send them at Odyssey, send them at Entropy, and I will definitely get to them. I want to run through some of the comments here. Apollo Invictus says the visuals in the Lynch film are extraordinary. Some of the visuals are extraordinary and some of them are really gloomy, and some of the process shots look really bad. Okay, Reed Siege. Okay, read The Silmarillion by Tolkien. Now, The Silmarillion is not something I want to reread because it's just a compendium of made-up myths. And it's like reading Hesiod, only much longer. You don't read Hesiod for pleasure. It's sort of a compendium of myths. However, at the very end of The Silmarillion is a summary of the story of the Lord of the Rings. And I can't think of a briefer piece of writing that's had more of an emotional impact on me. I mean, that brings tears to my eyes than that summary of the Lord of the Rings at the end of the Silmarillion. So it's worth reading just for that. And I definitely will reread that again and again. So yeah, that is definitely something worth reading. Salty Dog, or Alaska Chad Chaga writes in, Xenophon, my favorite Greek. He's not my favorite Greek, but he's one of the greats. The Anabasis is one of the great adventures from ancient history. And his history of his times, the Hellenica, is a continuation of Thucydides. His writings on Socrates, he has four writings on Socrates because he was a friend of Socrates, are extremely interesting and extremely valuable. So I'm a big Xenophon fan. My favorite Greeks are Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, though. Okay. So real Freemasonry has never been tried. Yes, Nick, that's a Lessing. So let me just see here if there are any more questions. I just don't want to let this go. I'm enjoying this too much. Odyssey, great take on Whoopi, Greg. The Jews can't help themselves. Yes. She should show a few hundred dear fellow white tweets. Exactly. Kids and their damn phones. Well, that's me. I'm starting to sound like an old guy because I'm starting to be an old guy and I just don't understand kids these days, even though I carry around my phone and I'm constantly checking on it too, but I'm doing serious things with my phone. I don't know what they're doing on their phones. Yeah. The globalists believe in Star Trek. Well, Star Trek is a globalistic fantasy. Exactly. The Road to Somewhere by David Goodhart might be a good analysis of nationalism versus globalism. Archie says that's it. That's actually a pretty good book. I just wish he would write shorter books because he's got good ideas, but then he pads them out excruciatingly. His book on higher education, which I can't even remember the title of, was excruciatingly padded out, but has a lot of really useful information in there. So yeah, David Goodhart is definitely a worthwhile writer and very useful to nationalists, national populists. Let's just put it that way. Yeah. Okay. So I've got a couple other questions here. Let me just check. These are things that people have emailed in. Oh, Happa Perspective wants to know if I'd like him to do gaming streams on our channels. Let me think about that. I need to talk this over with younger people because I'm hopelessly unhip and I don't know anything about what that would entail. Okay. Romanolox, $3. Thank you very much. I find myself more attracted to white culture and sympathetic to whites in general. Why do some non-white people turn out this way? Well, first of all, I'm glad you did. There are a lot of people who are not white who are attracted to white culture and civilization. White people have created a lot of wonderful things. And they're grateful for it. They appreciate these things. You go to the Far East and you can fill entire stadiums full of people who want to listen to Beethoven. They appreciate Western culture and civilization, and they recognize that without white people, these things aren't going to be around. Although Asians and the elites and other non-white societies have adopted and in some ways taken forward and added to Western cultural inventions and cultural forms. And of course, some of these civilizations have created things of value to the rest of the globe, and I appreciate them back. There is a level of universal culture, okay, of global culture, of things that are of objective merit, regardless of who created them. And the way that culture works is it's free when you get right down to it. If I have $100 in the bank and I share it with the rest of you folks, I have less of that $100. But if I have a good idea and I share it with you, I don't lose that good idea, right? The ideas, culture, ideal objects are not diminished by being shared. You don't lose a portion of a great idea by sharing it with somebody else. The idea just becomes bigger, right? It just becomes more inclusive and more encompassing. That's a difference between ideal objects and material objects. Culture is ultimately in the realm of ideas. Now, it's embodied in material objects like books and CDs and things like that. But the actual cultural achievement is an ideal thing. And it is not subject to the scarcity of material entities. And it is not chained down to the ethnicity, the historical situation, the other conditions of its creation. Now, these things are part of it, and they are a background that we bring to culture, right? But these objects have a certain independence that allows them to be appreciated across great gulfs of time and space and culture. And I think that's something remarkable. And there are people who are not white, who are attracted to white culture and appreciate white people for doing these things because that's possible. It's possible because there are certain things, certain truths, certain achievements that are objective, if you will, and not culture specific or not culture bound. They're not culture bound. They might be culture specific in their origins, but they're not culture bound in terms of their reception and their meaning and their influence. And this is why it's possible for Westerners to love Chinese music or Chinese art, or I'm more of a Japanophile myself. I guess that's not a surprise in our context. There are a lot of people who love Japan, but the Japanese like Western classical music, and I like Japanese composers and Japanese filmmakers and Japanese novelists too. So it's possible to appreciate these things, but in the end, your appreciation of them is going to be somewhat mediated by your own language and identity and race as well. So the idea that these things become just entirely detached, the idea that these things can become entirely detached from race and culture and context is false, but there is a level of ideal meaning that allows these things to be appreciated across these boundaries. And I think that that's maybe one of the things that's going on there. Now, somebody might call you a race traitor or something, or I don't know what they call, you know, I don't know what your race is. You know, they might call you an Oreo or something like that. I don't know. A coconut. But they're kind of missing the point. I'm not a race traitor for liking Toru Takemitsu's compositions. It's possible to be very rooted in your own race and people and tradition and still appreciate things that have been created of genuine value in other civilizations and in other ages as well. So that's an interesting question. That's a good question. Let's see if there are any other questions here. Yeah, I do like some anime. That's true. I like a lot of Japanese regular film. I like rap. No, rap is not serious culture. Okay. but I do like a lot of Japanese directors like Kobayashi and Kurosawa, people like that. These people are superb. Diversity plus proximity equals conflict. This is true. The West committed suicide when it gave women the vote. I don't know exactly if that was the big thing, but generally expanding the franchise has been a bad thing. Let's just put it that way. So, folks, okay, I want to wrap up now. So, folks, thank you very much. Thank you for putting up with me rambling in a solo stream. I wanted to have Morgoth on, but he's just exhausted with streams and he's exhausted talking about COVID. So I just decided, hell, I'm not going to scramble around looking for somebody. I'm just going to talk to you myself. And I've enjoyed it a lot. I want to thank all you listeners out there, of course. I want to thank our moderators for helping out. We were a little worried that some teen drama might intrude upon us. Our gossip columnist, Trav LeBlanc, has announced that he's left writing for Countercurrents because I don't sufficiently appreciate Nick Fuentes. And I always found Trav much more interesting than Nick Fuentes, to be perfectly honest. And it shocked me that we don't see eye to eye on that fact. But anyway, it's an odd thing that he's decided to do. And we are going to miss him. Even the people who are find Fuentes intolerable here are a little puzzled and sad to lose Trav. But he's gone off on his own. And I was thinking, okay, well, there might be some teen drama from the Fuentes sphere because of this. But fortunately, we're just too small over here in our little intellectual corner of the Wignat sphere. So I guess they passed us by. But I really appreciate the moderators for being extra vigilant today because this was a possible interruption to the stream. So anyway, thank you so much. Oh, and by the way, Trav is welcome to come back at any time because we value his work. He's a funny guy, talented and insightful. And I'm just kind of puzzled by this whole thing, to be perfectly honest. But I hope that it's just a passing thing and that we have him back because there's some absolutely fabulous, fabulous Trav LeBlanc type stories out there to be written. For instance, recently, the Center for the Study of the Radical Right, I think that's the name of it, published a piece critiquing Antifa, and a whole bunch of its researchers have up and resigned because they want to be linked with violent hooligans and terrorists. And I think that's really quite interesting. We've got a bunch of these people on the record now, and this is exactly the kind of drama that Trav is really good at writing about. Yeah, so anyway, I hope he comes back. Anyway, tomorrow, Nick Gilvey will be on the writer's block. That starts at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, 10 p.m. Central European time, where Nick is in Macedonia. And he is going to have on Jason Kessler. So I hope that you will all tune in tomorrow. And I will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Thanks.